Welcome to Resounds, Arts and Culture on the High Plains. I'm Corby Skinner.
And I'm Anna Page. And we're sharing stories of creative people who live and work in the Intermountain West. Very excited to have two writers in the studio today, Tim Lehman and Danelle Jones. Welcome.
Thank you.
Pleasure
Anna,
to
you
be
didn't
here.
Mention their husband and wife.
Oh, yes. These lovely folks are my neighbors, too, so I kind of take for granted that I get to know them a little bit more personally. But yes, husband, wife, writer team have been doing a lot of great research on these two new books that have just come out, and we're pretty excited to get to talk to you a little bit more about them.
So both your books deal with the circumstance of history. Tim's book, Up the Trail, begins and is dramatically colored by the events up to the Civil War and after the Civil War. And Danelle's book, An African and Imperial London, covers the time from 1904 to when the main character dies from TB right at the end of World War I. So I'm thinking as we discuss your books, I want to think about how the unique stories that you're telling are created by a larger world history, perhaps, and then what the stories that you're telling contribute to our understanding of class, race, economy, and social history.
Tim, why don't we start with you? Let's dive in. Now, the Longhorn Texas cattle, they weren't really that meaty. How has this breed dominated the industry for so long?
Well, you know, the Longhorns came over as Spanish cattle and then over many generations developed these longer horns and became wild and semi-wild. They were perfectly suited for that. Long and lean, rangy, could travel, could defend themselves. But exactly right, they were not so meaty, and so they often had a hard time. They dominated so much because of their reputation for toughness, for being able to defend themselves, to take care of themselves on the range. But the truth is they always had to be fattened up before they went to market. So they always had to have some corn or some nice plush grass feed at the end of their life's journey before they were good for beef for the table.
Mm. And Longhorns were also really good on the trail. They sort of followed well, correct?
Yes, absolutely. Charles Goodnight said they were the best trailing cattle ever because they could, long legs, lean bodies, they could walk long distances, they could go long distances without water. And so all of that made them, in a sense, some people have seen them as almost their own labor force for getting them to market. They got themselves there.
So they were bringing cattle from Texas up to Kansas, but people in Kansas were either very happy to have them come up to Kansas in terms of the towns and the business that came with the cowboys and the cow drive, and other farmers were not so crazy about it because longhorns also brought disease. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, longhorns, like most southern cattle, had a specific kind of tick that carried a disease that was often fatal to other cattle who were not used to that, who had not been bred up with that as part of their environment. And so this is part of almost the Civil War sectional animosity, as Kansas people objected to these Texas longhorns that, well, might kill their entire herd of cattle. And so there are a lot of hostilities over that. At the same time, a lot of Kansas business people wanted the business that the Longhorns cattle and the cattle herders brought to their towns. And that Texas fever, that cattle tick that carried the Texas fever, is what is responsible for the location of the cattle towns in Texas, because they had to be just west of the quarantine line, which was pushing ever westward as settlement moved westward. So we go from Abilene as the first cattle town and then ultimately to Dodge City out in western Kansas. And sort of what killed the cattle drives once and for all was when the entire state of Kansas and Colorado refused to take any more Texas cattle with their ticks.
Now, I'm curious about the cowboy. You know, in all of this research that you've done, what did you uncover about the cowboy. I know that there's a very romanticized idea of running cattle and that Western idea. So is there a typical cowboy that was at this time?
The cowboy was more a sort of a proletariat on horseback, a hired hand. It was a gritty, earthy existence. The cowboys of the cattle trails tended to be young, sometimes very young as 12, often teenagers. And they also, many of them were African American or Mexican Americans, people who had experience handling and herding cattle, but were available to do this work for not very much pay. It's also, I think, important to remember that as much as we have romanticized this job, the actual cowboys who went up the trail, who started in Texas, went to Kansas on these long drives, most of them did it only once. It wasn't so much fun that they wanted to repeat that experience.
They kept coming back. Why do you think the mythology has persisted of this very romantic expedition that they went on?
You know, in the 1880s, just as the actual cattle drives were ending, America's at this rapidly industrializing and urbanizing moment in its history, and it looked for this pre-industrial folk hero, and the cowboy fit the bill fairly well. Now, they had to dress him up a little bit, and by dress him up, I don't mean necessarily literally. They turned him into a more autonomous individualist than he was. They emphasized his skill with guns and his relationship with his horse, who could carry him with limitless freedom over the open prairie. And so it in the dime novels, the Wild West shows, and ultimately the movies, you get this much romanticized and but very fun hero.
And I think it's interesting when you talk about what Owen Wister did to the story of the cowboy. One, he eliminated black people and Mexicans and made them gunslingers rather than just cowboys, so that we'd like that individual character that was epitomized by one particular cowboy that was in Buffalo Bill Cody's show. Can you tell us about that man?
So there was a man named Buck Taylor, who was, in fact, a Texas cowboy, came up the trail, worked for Buffalo Bill Cody, and became kind of the perfect model of the mythological cowboy. He was tall, about 6'4". He was a good horseman. He rode. And so Buffalo Bill Cody made him the star of the show. He even went to London and appeared before the Queen. He would do tricks like ride at a full gallop and pick a handkerchief off the floor. So he had all these this bad
something dress. You didn't usually do on the cattle trail?
Not really a skill that one needed on the cattle trail. You know, they not only emphasize those trick riding skills and trick gun skills, but they leave behind the cows. They sort of whiten up the hero, leaving behind the Mexican vaquero and the African Americans. And they leave behind the cows, too, when they make the mythological hero.
So we associate alcohol and prostitution with many of the towns of the Old West, but they really help the community prosper. In your research for this book, what did you discover about that?
I always knew that alcohol and prostitution were part of the picture. What surprised me about these cattle towns is that they used alcohol, prostitution, which were technically illegal, but they would allow it to happen, and then once a month or so, on a fairly regular basis, they would fine the participants in the alcohol or the prostitution business as if it were kind of a tax, and that then would go into the city coffers, and that's what paid the bills for the sheriffs and all the other things that the city used. The sheriffs, by the way, were not so much your gunslinging heroes as they were organizers of groups of men who would try to keep the streets safe from these Texas cowboys during the cattle season. And the rest of the year, they'd clean the streets and sweep the sidewalks and handle all these boring, mundane tasks.
Sure, kind of like the grocery store and the clothing store that sprung up at this time.
Right. I mean, it's interesting that almost invariably the first thing that the cowboys do when they got into town was go to the grocery store and the clothing store. And then they'd go to the saloon and the brothel and the dance floor.
So the railroads also have a big part in sort of starting why we had a cattle drive to begin with and why they sort of ended afterwards. Can you talk about how the railroads impacted cattle drives?
Yeah, so in some ways, these cattle drives can be seen as a long walk to the railway station. The railroads hadn't gotten to Texas by the end of the Civil War, and Texans had as many as 5 million Longhorn cattle on the range. So in order to turn these cattle into cash, they had to get them to market. And the railroads were just stretching into Kansas at the time. So the railroads became the crucial meeting point of these Texas cattle and the global market, the Chicago and Kansas City stockyards.
Why don't we head from cattle towns to Freetown? Donnell, I'm really dying to talk to you about this book. It's such a fascinating story. And how did you come across this subject? It seems like he's been buried in history.
He has been buried in history. I was working on another project, in fact, and as I was going through archives and libraries, I came across some of his writing, and it was so fascinating, charming, funny, smart. I just wondered, who is this guy? And as I started to look around, there was just really one paragraph of information about him. And I found him so fascinating. I kept researching him, and I thought he would just be a minor, maybe a smaller character in a bigger book. And then he took over and became his own book.
And his history starts, this is the part of your book I could not believe, how Nova Scotia and Sierra Leone have any connection whatsoever. And I'm going to have the readers find that out. But tell us a little bit about where he was born and how unusual Freetown was in Sierra Leone.
So he was born in 1877 in Freetown, which one colonial administrator called really England in Africa. The group he was from, the Creos, were very influenced by British culture. They wore British clothes. He was given a British education. And he considered himself a British subject. So he really saw himself as an Afro-British person. And that was a key to his identity.
Now, London as well becomes quite the character in the book as he takes, off from Sierra Leone into London. Tell us what it was like at the turn of the century.
Do you want me to read a little bit?
Oh, yeah. It'd be great to hear a little bit from the book.
Okay. The year Merriman Labor arrived, London was the biggest city in the world, home to 6 million people, famous for its traffic, its fog, its international port, its powerful financial center, and its pickpockets. Mm-hmm. A massive 693 square miles, Greater London was bigger than Paris, Berlin, or New York. As the center of a global empire, it governed the lives and fortunes of some 400 million people. Its port was the busiest in the world, the center of a trading network that stretched to every continent. Warehouses, some of them 8 stories high, lined the north bank of the Thames and housed international goods, tea, wool, rubber, meat, cinnamon, wine, cotton, feathers, ivory, and more. Because the more delectable freight attracted swarms of rats, the city employed cats by the thousands. The discrepancies between rich and poor in the great metropolis were mind-boggling. A high court judge might make £15,000 a year or more, a chairwoman barely 30. Women of the upper class were expected to wear different attire for every activity, tea dresses, ball gowns, walking clothes, and cycling gear, not to mention costumes for motoring, traveling by sea, getting married, or mourning the death of a loved one's. Laborers and their families had to get by with one set of tattered clothes and one ragged pair of shoes. Wealthy families rattled around country houses with 100 rooms and more than 50 servants at their disposal, while families of dock workers crammed together in tight quarters near river warehouses to avoid transportation costs. Those lucky enough to be born in the upper class could live into their 70s, but those with the misfortune to be members of the working class would be lucky to reach 40.
Wow, the contrast is just stark here.
Yes, and it's something that Merriman Labor cared about because in his book, Britons Through Negro Spectacles, he describes coming across a woman on the street holding a baby in her arms. Her clothes are tattered, and she has a sign pinned to her shirt that says, Dear Friend, Have Pity, Mother of 18, All Starving.
Wow.
He seemed to understand. He was an African, but thought of himself as very British. And he understood that there needs to be some sort of commerce, communication, stories running back from London back to Africa. So he had a lot of schemes.
He did.
Some worked and some didn't work. Tell us about what his vision was for what his role was in London.
Well, his big dream was to become a writer. He loved British literature, and that really was at the heart of his identity. But he also was driven to try to improve the state of Africans and to help those in Europe, England and Europe, understand who Africans were. He felt they didn't really understand who they were. And he also felt that Europeans had control of African natural resources and that Africans needed to take control of their resources. And so he started the African General Agency to help Africans begin to earn more money from the things they produced. And his larger idea was that once they started to get control of their resources, they then could develop that into manufacturing. And so all the wealth that has long poured out of Africa and continues to pour out of Africa today would go to Africans and not just to European countries.
No, he was identifying himself as British and therefore, I think, too, picked up on manners and the class structure. He was quite the storyteller. Did you get a sense of where his humor might have come from?
I don't think his humor came from his family because he had a very religious, perhaps even dour grandfather who raised him, very strictly religious. His mother also seems quite serious. So I surmise that he got his humor from reading, and he loved Mark Twain. And when he published his book, one newspaper called him the Negro Mark Twain, and he loved that. And so he really loved the idea of using humor and satire to address social causes, which he saw Twain doing.
I think it's interesting, and you talk about this briefly, that he was very flamboyant. He loved clothes, loved socializing, but he knew nothing about sex. And he said, I have never loved or been loved. Do you think he might have been a gay African Brit in the turn of the century?
It's quite possible. And we do know of other African men who were in England at that time who were, won't say openly gay, but who were known to be gay. That was never an identity that he claimed. And unfortunately, we don't know enough to know for sure. It's going to be one of those mysteries about his life. We don't really know the secrets of his heart. But many African men came to England and actually married British women, had families with British women. So although some segments of the society looked down on that, it happened very often. And so it would not have been unlikely that he might have done that. And why he chose not to, we need more information to give a firm answer on that.
Talk a little bit about the research that was involved in this. You said 7 years in the making. So
yes.
I imagine you have spent a lot of time digging, not only through what you can find online, but in person. You were just overseas at the British Library.
Yes, we took many trips to the British Library, to the National Archives at Kew, and many other archives, libraries, museums, and collections of information books. I looked at newspapers, court records, business documents, all kind passenger lists. I tried to glean information from anywhere I could, because when you have so many people that we know about, we have their biographies because people have left diaries and letters and other people knew them. So we have a mass of information. But with Black British people in this period, many of them have not left a huge personal record. So we have to get at the information through the public record. And you really try to go. I used advertisements. I found interesting things about him through advertisements. I emailed. He says that in his book that he went to the Bunyan Museum because he was quite Christian. And so he went there and he talked about it and he described signing the book. So I just emailed them one day and I said, oh, do you have a book from, I think it was 1907, your guest book? And they said, we do. I said, well, could you find this entry? They found it and sent me a scanned a copy of it. So I have his signature in the book. And when it's somebody who you only know through traces, you cherish everything that you find.
I bet finding a signature like that, it's almost like getting to know him through all of these little tiny pieces.
Yes. And the other thing that I did, too, is you read histories and other memoirs of the period, so you can fill things out through other people's experiences as well.
Yeah, and it shows in the writing, certainly.
And I would also say that's why London is a character, mm-hmm. right? Because really, to fill out his story and give it some emotional depth, you really need to have a sense of his context and what he was dealing with. Because I can't quote from a million letters or diaries.
Yeah, it makes sense why there's such a vivid scene in the book.
Miriam Labor died at a very early age, 38, is that correct?
41.
41. But his most important book, Britons Through Negro Spectacles, never really caught on or was popular. Do you think if he had lived longer, he would be more well known?
I do think so, because one thing I always think about, Virginia Woolf wrote when she was 40 years old that she had finally found her voice when she wrote the novel Jacob's Room. And I thought that is exactly the age Merriman Labor was when he was dying. And that's when we really see her hitting her stride. And I think if his financial situation had been better and he'd had the opportunity to mature, you know, at least two of his books are lost. Well, three may be lost. Three of his works may be lost. That his books may have survived. He might have made it through World War I and the 20s. There was a renewed interest in sort of Pan-African culture. And somebody might have taken an interest in him then. I was talking to a fellow historian, and we talked about our common dream that one day somebody would open up a trunk stuck under a bed somewhere in Freetown that had been there for 100 years, and suddenly we would find he wrote letters. He wrote to his mother every week. So you know there are hundreds of letters. There were hundreds of letters at one time. But so our dream is that one day a trove will be discovered.
Tim, that brings me to a question I have about your book and the cattle drive. There are almost as many pages of annotated notes in your book as there is text. You must have had just unbelievable resources of material in terms of purchases and stories to work from.
In that sense, my research task was the opposite of Donnell's, because I did have so much available to me. So many stories and narratives are not only available in the archives, but are in print somewhere, so I can read them from the comfort of my own house. And, of course, the thing to do is, you know, it's a different kind of task. You have to read and synthesize and sort and what's important and what's trustworthy. Because the sentimentalizing and romanticizing of that experience began very early. So even people who were went up the trail, by the time they're older and remembering it, they've already started to mythologize it.
I wanted to transition to talk about what we started with at the beginning, which was your life together. How did you go about researching and living together and trying to get books published? It just seems like it is a lot for just one person to be working on a book project, and then you've got the two of you together. So is it easier, more difficult? Tell us about your life a bit.
You know, I love research. So when Donnell's looking for bits and pieces and, you know, so these little parts of the puzzle that are there somewhere in the archives, I just, you know, plow into that work with great joy. And that's a lot of fun for me. Donnell happens to be, in my experience, and I'm not exaggerating here, the best editor of prose that I've ever known. And so she makes everything I write better. Much better. And I'd like to think we help each other out in those ways.
Well, I think we definitely help each other out because Tim has amazing resilience in archives. I remember one day at the British Library, we'd been there for hours and we hadn't found anything. And I was just worn out. It was about 4 p.m. And I said, oh, I think I have to go home. I'm done. He goes, oh, no, let's just stay another hour. And he stayed another hour and found a really wonderful document that had been misfiled. misfiled. It wasn't even where it was supposed to be. And he had the diligence and stick-to-itiveness to find that, and it made a huge difference. And we also had another wonderful and terrible experience together, and this was in the National Archives at Kew. As I said, when I began this, nobody knew when or how Merriman Labor had died. In fact, one scholar had told me they thought perhaps he'd moved to California. And I thought, won't that be nice? I can do research in California. And we were going through the death rolls, and we knew probably where he was living and some other information about him, and we found his name. And we looked at each other, and we were so happy. We found it! We found it! We know now! And then just a split second later, we looked at each other and thought, oh my God, we've lost him. He's dead. It was made him dead for the first time to us. And then we had to mourn him. And it was this moment of elation at finding it and then sadness to know that we had lost him at such an early age. So it was really a kind of, this work is more emotional than you would expect.
Well, and you have a lot of passion involved in what you do, and it really shows in your writing, so.
So sometimes history reveals itself, and other times it keeps its cards close to the chest.
Yes.
How fun to be able to do this together. And then to get your books published in the same year, this probably was not necessarily purposeful. I know that it's very difficult sometimes to get your books out into the world. Danelle, you were working on getting this published for a bit when it was finally picked up.
Yes. I had found an agent, and it took him several months to sell it to Hearst, which is an amazing publisher in London.
And Tim, did you have any hiccups in your publishing process, or did you kind of have a home for this book as you were writing?
I had a home in mind all along. In fact, they had talked to me about writing this and sort of even talked me into writing it in some ways. But then the only problem along the way, probably delayed it by about a year, is they had some sort of crisis in editors, and I don't know what was going on there, but they kept changing editors, and so I started not the writing process, but started the editing process all over again about three times on their end.
Oh, wow. Well, glad that both of these books are in the world, and you can find more about it on our website. We'll have links to both of your books and where people can get them, and we're really happy to have you here in the studio today.
Thank you, Tim and Danelle.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It's great to be here.
Resounds, Arts and Culture on the High Plains is produced by Corby Skinner, Anna Page, and Ken Siebert for Yellowstone Public Radio. Theme music by Alex Naumann. Additional funding provided by the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication on issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans. More information on Resounds is available at ypradio.org.